What's up? Welcome back to Nostalgia. Dave here with another pod. What's going on in pop culture right now? Small pod this week, but a few key things to get into. Going to react to Spotify Wrapped 2023, both the global listening trends as well as my own personal stats. Always like digging into that data. Always fun. And then a few key releases. Three movies. Godzilla Minus One, the new Japanese Godzilla film from Toho, unconnected from the Monarch Legacy of Monsters Apple series. And Godzilla Minus One is amazing. Can't wait to talk about that. Also, now on Netflix now, Todd Haynes' new drama film, May December, starring Julianne Moore and Natalie Portman. And also, John Woo's return to Hollywood after 15 years or so with Silent Night, starring Joel Kinnaman. So, three notable movie releases, plus Spotify Wrapped. So make sure you subscribe, youtube.com/nostalgiapod, linktree.com/nostalgiapod. See the links below, see the Spotify playlist. A lot of best of year-end pods coming up. Best movies, TV, music, all kinds. So make sure you subscribe, come back for those, as well as the normal pods throughout the end of the year. And yeah, let's get into it. What's up? Welcome back to Nostalgia. Dave here with my reaction to 2023 Spotify Wrapped. Yes, our favorite time of the year is back. To me, it's probably the best and most fun part of user data collection. We know that we are being watched and listened to. At least give us some fun data insights. In the case of Spotify Wrapped, I'm always very interested in what my listening habits pertained. I always find personal statistics like that very interesting. So I am a big fan of Spotify Wrapped. I'm not a curmudgeon who complains about seeing people sharing them on their stories. By all means, share what you listen to. And yeah, I think there's nothing too surprising about like the global trends with Spotify Wrapped. Just kind of going through it here. If you look globally, number one artist was Taylor Swift. On its surface, perhaps not a huge surprise, but Bad Bunny had been the number one global artist the last 3 years in a row. He is now down to number two this year. So Taylor breaking that Bunny win streak, I'm sure he'll be back. Rounding out the top five, The Weeknd, Drake, and Peso Pluma at number five. I reviewed Peso Pluma's album back in June, Genesis. I was saying how big a deal he was becoming very quickly, and I also bemoaned the Grammys for surprisingly omitting him from Best New Artist, despite nominating him in a different category, a genre category. Proof is in the pudding here. Peso Pluma is absolutely gigantic out of Mexico. Insane stuff. Really cool. So that top four minus Peso Pluma is the same from last year, just a different order. Pluma taking the place of BTS this time around. BTS, of course, on hiatus. No new material at album length this past year as a group, so that makes plenty of sense. On the album side of things, it's funny. The number one album was still from Bad Bunny. It was Un Verano Sin Ti, which, of course, is from last year. Number two was Midnight's. Number three from Taylor. Then number three was SZA's SOS. I guess that all kind of makes sense. Midnight's and SOS specifically came out at the very end of 2022. Nothing too surprising. Also, like, we never had, like, a monster new album come out this year. And if you look at the big song list, you can kind of see that trend. Number one song of the year globally, Flowers, 1.6 billion streams, certainly helped by the fact that that came out at the very beginning of the year. Number two is Kill Bill from SZA. Number three, As It Was from Harry. Obviously a very old song at this point. I feel like As It Was is kind of replaced. Blinding Lights is like that just ubiquitous pop song that's just sticking around forever. So kind of interesting. Number four, Jungkook's Seven, which I think is a song that has a chance to perhaps pass Flowers and Kill Bill. That song is just absolutely gigantic. And then number five was El Baila Sola from Peso Pluma. Surprise, surprise. Also on that list in the top 10 global songs, number six, Taylor Swift's Cruel Summer. Very impressive considering that is a song from 2019. Metro Boomin, The Weeknd, and 21 Savage's Creepin'. This song obviously became a huge hit. Definitely surprising. Obviously, The Weeknd carried this song to its popularity, but if you look at the overall billions on billions of streams for Metro Boomin in general, apart from this song, it's kind of crazy how big an artist he became off that Heroes and Villains album from the end of last year. Also in the top 10, at 10, you have Anti-Hero from Taylor, the only person with two songs in the global top 10. Calm Down by Rema featuring Selena Gomez. Shout out Afrobeats. Rema, rapidly rising, new face in that scene for sure. Then in the US, you know, that top five for artists, slightly different, but just barely. Number one, Taylor. Number two, Drake. Number three, Morgan Wallen. Number four, Weeknd. Number five, Bunny. Nothing too surprising with that, I think. And yeah, I mean, number one podcast, once again, Joe Rogan. Nothing too surprising there. You know, my personal Wrapped, I actually listened to less music overall, and they gave me the Hypnotist personality, which is what they give you if you play albums all the way through, which I thought was really funny because me personally, I actually listened to, I think, less overall albums this year, and I sampled a lot more as a result. So it's the year I've actually followed that track to the least degree, funny enough. In terms of my artists, number one was Drake, no surprise. He had an album I really liked come out at the end of last year that I listened to into this year. And of course, he released a new album very recently. So Drake almost always is number one for me or close to it. And part of that is because he always releases new music. So not a big surprise. Number two is Le Sserafim. Number three is NewJeans. Two K-pop artists in my top five. Not a big shock for me. Le Sserafim, I didn't really discover and start listening until to the very beginning of this year anyway. So that certainly helps. Of course, NewJeans had two drops this year. And Le Sserafim had a new drop as well. So it all makes sense. Number four for me is Jahlil, the alternative rapper. I certainly dove into his music, in the spring. But I'm kind of surprised that he was up this high. I mean, I liked his song Dive In, the remix of it, a lot. But I was surprised to see Jahlil this high. I'm not going to lie. I'm not sure how accurate that is. Number five is Troye Sivan, whose album is one of my favorite albums of the year. I love the lead single off it, Rush. That one's great. Top genre rap overall. And then... following rap, my next genres are pop, K-pop, alternative R&B, and then K-pop girl group as a genre that's somehow different from K-pop. Kind of dumb. Very dumb. They're the same thing. Kind of weird. Yeah. Anyway, looking at my top songs, my number one, I pretty much was positive was going to be the case. It's Popular from The Weeknd featuring Playboi Carti and Madonna off the Idol soundtrack, the HBO series. And then number three is World Class Sinner / I'm a Freak by Lily Rose Depp, also off the Idol soundtrack. Idol, a show I didn't like. In the end, I reviewed the show, but I love those songs. Those songs are bangers. They're the best thing about the show. And there they are, one and three. Number two is Jumbotron Shit Poppin' from Drake off Her Loss last year. Wouldn't have guessed that off the rip as my number one Her Loss song, but it certainly tracks. Number four is Dumbest Girl Alive from 100 Gex off their new album, 10,000 Gex from this year. Surprised to see you quite this high, but I certainly love the song. You know, the Coheed and Cambria-esque riff, the way that song jumps in, certainly had me going back to it a lot. And the number five for me is Bottle Service by Shoreline Mafia, which is a song from like 2017 that I kind of rediscovered this year. I'm a big Shoreline Mafia fan. They're, of course, a group that's no longer together. And I kind of realized that Bottle Service is perhaps their best song of all, and I kind of overlooked it to this point. So yeah, there it is at number five. You know, looking at the playlist they give you for more insights into your top song after that top five. Number six was K-Flock Shake It. Number seven, Jungkook 7. Number eight, Troye Sivan's Rush. Number nine, Hype Boy by NewJeans. Number 10, Major Distribution by Drake and 21. Yeah, all that makes a lot of sense. You know, Shake It. Seven, really catchy songs. Hype Boy, probably up there with my favorite K-pop songs of all time. Really cool. Got some EDM up here. Listen to Fred Against Delilah a ton. Medusa's Piece of Your Heart a lot. They're here. Yeah, pretty good. I mean, I like the look of this playlist I have here. I think most people would. And that's what's fun about rap to me. And the Apple Music version of it as well. Like, just getting the insights into what you actually enjoy and seeing it present to you in data. Yes, they're spying, but they're spying anyway. At least make it fun. Very few entities in tech do this to us, right? So I'm with it. Shout out Spotify Wrapped. Leave a comment. Let me know what do you think of my stats. Tell me about your Spotify Wrapped. What do you think about the global rap stats, etc. Let me know how you're feeling, and make sure you return for my best music of 2023 pod coming soon. Subscribe, youtube.com/nostalgiapod. Let me know, that's coming up soon. Best K-pop songs of the year also coming up, and yeah, see you next time. What's up? Welcome back to Nostalgia. Dave here with a review of Silent Night, the new action film from John Woo, starring Joel Kinnaman. Yes, John Woo is back with a Hollywood film, his first Hollywood film in 20 years since 2004. Of course, John Woo, famous Chinese action auteur, probably most well known to American audiences for his movies such as Face Off and, of course, Mission Impossible 2, as well as Wind Talkers, a few other movies. And yeah, it's been a long time for Wu, of course, and I definitely wasn't expecting him to actually even make a comeback such as this, but it's kind of fun that he's making a comeback with like a true action movie, in the vein, of course, of his most celebrated works over in China, such as Hard Boiled. And yeah, Silent Night, the central conceit, the central gimmick is, of course, that this movie has basically no dialogue, because Joel Kinnaman's character is this father whose young son is killed by a stray bullet from a gang member in LA, and thus he goes on a rampage of revenge. But early on in the start of the story, he gets shot and loses his vocal cords, loses his ability to speak. So as a result, the movie, the script, has basically no dialogue. There's a few lines here and there. There's some radio dialogue. So there are words throughout the movie, but it's largely quiet. It's looks, presence, gestures, etc. And that is an interesting premise. And you know, I think ultimately Silent Night, I think it's like an okay time, but the action chops of this aren't as like up to par as I would have expected from someone of Wu's caliber and ability. You know, he's kind of dialed back his like really flashy style that, again, American audiences probably know from when he took things too a little too far with Mission Impossible 2. It's and in the time we're living in now with action movies, right? You know, post The Raid, post John Wick, you know, even minor, smaller stuff like Atomic Blonde or Nobody. Like, we have a high bar for like hand-to-hand action. And I just don't know if the set pieces really like rise to the pretty high bar that we now have for like real true action beat-em-up movies. So while I think it's like there's interesting things about the movie, it ultimately kind of falls a bit flat by the end. But there are some interesting elements of, you know, Kinnaman, I think he's a interesting actor for this kind of movie as well, because Kinnaman, someone who was ostensibly going to become a star, you know, 10 plus years ago, it never quite happened, even though he's had some big roles. He's continued to work. I'm a big fan of him in For All Mankind, for example, but he's never truly become like the A-lister people might have thought. And Kinnaman, he's kind of a fun fit for this because Wu really like takes his time with the training montage, as it were, where Kinnaman's character decides that he's going to take a year to train and study this gang operation and then wipe them out the following Christmas, you know, and because Christmas is when he loses his son, roughly. And it's like really dark and procedural in the training montage, watching him watch YouTube videos to learn how to like properly stab someone and all the things he's doing to get himself stronger after, you know, nearly dying, of course, in the very beginning of the story. And it's not like really cerebral or like fun or jubilant montage. It's very like tactical and dark because this character is just subsumed by his darkness and his rage because of his grief. His wife basically has no choice but to leave him because he just completely breaks down and can't communicate. And you're basically watching a guy lose his mind and seek and fulfill his death wish. And some of the action is fun. I think some of the story is a bit confusing. Like there's a open gang war sequence that he kind of pulls up on, and it's a little muddled, kind of what's going on. Watching him kind of roll around the Mustang, he like soups up and just kind of shooting people out the window and stuff. It's all pretty fun. And in the final action set piece where he attacks the gang hideout, there's a notable like staircase sequence where he basically just walks up the staircase with his shotgun, with his pistols, knife, etc., and it starts taking people down. But the thing is, it's really not much beyond that. Like, we had a really amazing staircase set piece in 2017 with Atomic Blonde, And this just kind of feels like a carbon copy of it that doesn't have any inspiration. Again, kind of weird from someone like Wu. I think Wu was really going for like the really self-seriousness of this character, but the spectacle doesn't rise above to a special degree to, I think, really reward you for sitting with something so dour and self-serious the entire time. You know, there's a kind of a subplot with Kid Cudi's LAPD character as this detective who kind of gives Kinnaman's character some intel subtly and basically okays his ability to go on his vigilante mission. But, like, you have Cudi not saying anything, right? Because that's how this movie works. And he's just kind of there for the most part. The gang characters, there's some interesting visuals, like the main bad guy with all the, like, the tattoos on the side of his face and stuff. But, like, really kind of a non-entity as a character, so... Yeah, I think, like, ultimately it's a pretty surface-level movie, which would have been more okay if I think the action rose above just being completely average to me. Like, so I ultimately was pretty let down by the movie. Even though I thought it was a decent watch, it wasn't too long, didn't overstay its welcome, but at the end, like, that self-seriousness, I think, kind of got to me, and, like, it's a bit of a flat ending. Like, it's a predictable path, but also, like, I just needed a little bit more spectacle, I think. You know, Wu, to his credit, you know, jumping out of the camera, the way he cuts and stuff, that all looks pretty cool. But I just don't think the set piece has had enough inspiration, enough vision. So it's okay. I'm very curious, honestly, more than anything else. Like, is John Woo going to continue to work? Obviously, he's on the older side of things as a director. Not that, of course, that means too much nowadays. Look at Ridley and Martin Scorsese, if you think about recent movies. But what is Wu going to do next? Is he going to make something else in Hollywood? Is he going to keep working over in China, do a mix of both, who's to say? But hopefully he continues to work, because obviously he's someone with a unique vision, you know, and even if I would have liked this movie to be more like Michael Bay's Ambulance, for example, it was not. Nonetheless, it's okay, I appreciate the attempt. But let me know, what did you think of Silent Night? Were you let down by John Woo's Hollywood comeback the way I was? What do you want next for Joel Kinnaman? Let me know, and for more movie reviews, subscribe, and I'll see you next time. What's up? Welcome to Nostalgia. Dave here with a review of May December, the new drama film from Todd Haynes, out now on Netflix, starring Julianne Moore, Natalie Portman, and Charles Melton. May December premiered back at Cannes earlier this year, got scooped up by Netflix, and is certainly in the Oscars mix, I would say. And I think a big part of that, and part of the reason Netflix wanted to get involved, this is a very, I think, juicy subject. And, of course, with a talented filmmaker of the caliber of Todd Haynes, his first movie since 2019's Dark Waters, obviously a lot to like, talented cast, obviously, at the front as well. And, yeah, I think this premise is definitely something you just got to wrap your head around right away, where it's basically inspired by the story of Mary Kay Letourneau, where Julianne Moore's character, Gracie, she, in the past, before the movie takes place, Gracie had, as a married woman, had an illicit affair with Charles Melton's character, Joe, when Joe had just completed the seventh grade. Obviously a crime. Gracie, and since goes to jail, but then after she leaves jail, leaves prison, her, Gracie and Joe have a relationship together and have a new family, have kids. And we're at the place now at the story where Gracie and Joe's youngest kids are about to graduate high school. And, you know, despite the fact that Joe is only in his, like, you know, mid-30s. And Natalie Portman's character, Elizabeth, is a, you know, pretty well-known actor who is going to be playing the role of Gracie in an independent film. And she is coming down to Savannah to meet Gracie and meet the family as a form of observation and study and learning and preparation for the role. Obviously, there's a lot to chew on with that, with something so seedy as, like, the central conceit of the story, but also kind of equally seedy is the fact that someone would want to get so close to do this kind of study for almost, like, methody acting, right? Daniel Day-Lewis would certainly be interested in an approach to this degree, right? And in the movie, it's an interesting movie where, like, I appreciate the strength of the acting performances, but ultimately, the way this script works, the way this story is told, it's more minimalist. It's more, I think it's steady even though Julianne Moore and Natalie Portman, they're definitely kind of going for it. Like Julianne Moore, her character has a lisp. When there's a crying scene where she really strongly tears up and sobs, as we know she can. Julianne Moore definitely doing her thing, and she's really tremendous in the movie. And Portman, I think, does a good job as well. This is right at home with kind of a lot of the roles she's been taking the past, you know, 10 plus years of her career. This is kind of the kind of darker thing she's tended to do with stuff like Fox Lux and Jackie and even way back to Black Swan at this point. Like, this is in Natalie Portman's role. And then you have Charles Melton, who's been the big breakthrough with this movie. Melton is being heralded as someone in the Best Supporting Actor mix at the Oscars. Of course, Charles Melton, famous from Riverdale. I had not seen him in Riverdale. I didn't watch Riverdale, so this is my first time seeing him. I definitely think he's strong, but it's a bit of a reserved, steady performance that only has a brief, real scene or scene and a half of showiness, and this is not really what this movie is about. So I think it's a hard movie to truly put your arms around, but it's a story, you know, it's a world to be in the middle of that definitely will leave you thinking about it after you've watched the movie. So it's certainly interesting. It's certainly unique, even if I wasn't completely on board with everything about it. And yeah, I think ultimately, like, the way the movie is structured, where really it's just Elizabeth kind of meeting the family, the meeting acquaintances and people in the community and stuff, and just asking questions, basically a series of informal interviews as she's just trying to learn things. But you start, I think what's interesting about May December as well is you have that structure, right? But then the movie kind of like shifts you as the audience, like your feelings on like who you are rooting for, or like what you think about what's going on. Like the tone kind of like varies and ebbs and flows. And, you know, like there's a moment where Elizabeth goes to the pet store where Gracie and Joe were caught all those years ago, you know, copulating. And she goes to the storeroom where they got the back storeroom where they got caught in the store, and kind of like lays down and like puts herself in the scene and like pretending she's like in the throes of it. It's like, huh, like what's going on with this character, right? Like how, and like you start to feel that she's being more manipulative. She gets invited to one of Gracie and Joe's kids' high school acting class, and she gets asked kind of like a crude, immature question from one of the boys in the class about filming sex scenes, and she takes that as an opportunity to like talk about when the line gets bridged, and like you can tell that she's putting on a performance and kind of having fun with how she's carrying herself in this situation. Meanwhile, like you can tell Gracie is completely sociopathic, like the way she manipulates and micromanages her children, but also as it's quickly revealed and you spend more time with it, what she's done to Joe. Obviously, from the very beginning, you understand that like Joe was in a situation where he was not able to consent legally, of course, and then furthermore, it's like quite revealed that he is a victim, not just for that criminal aspect, but also to the fact that he is very emotionally stunted by this whole situation, and like the decision making, the agency was taken away from him in a huge aspect of his life. And when you spend time with Charles Melton's portrayal of Joe, you feel like you're spending time with like a adolescent person who happens to be like 35, and it's kind of sad. And like, you know, you have this moment, which I think is like really important in the movie, where Elizabeth and Joe like hook up real quick and fuck, and Elizabeth's just like, this is what grown-ups do. It's like an amazing line. But Joe just like cannot rationalize, wrap his head around things, because he just doesn't know so many aspects of, I think, controlling your life, you know. And there's this kind of motif through the beginning and end of the movie where Joe takes care of monarch butterflies as like a form of like amateur conservationism, basically. And you could kind of see the metaphor plainly where Joe, he's still the larva, right? He never got to blossom and fly away because of what Gracie did to him, despite Gracie's protestations that it was Joe who wanted it, and it was Joe who seduced her, and all these kind of wild things to say so many years after the past. And yeah, I think a lot of those interview scenes are quite interesting. Like, yeah, there's one where we spend time with one of Gracie's older kids from her original marriage, Corey Michael Smith's character, Georgie. Georgie makes, a really strong impression in basically two scenes as well. Definitely kind of leapt off the screen for me. And yeah, I think just, it's weird though, because Elizabeth being like the audience avatar in a sense, even though she clearly has this pretty self-centered agenda for what she's doing and kind of poking at open wounds in the community, in the family, for her own gain, for the most part. It's interesting. And I think Melton, you know, the scene he has when he hooks up with Portman, directly into the confrontation that Joe and Gracie have, where Melton, I think that's where he gets to be his most emotional, his most expressive, even though Joe really has a hard time communicating things like this because he just doesn't know it any other way. But it's so unsettling watching him, you know, kind of come to the realization of what's happened to him, really perhaps for the first time. And yeah, there's no like fine answers to this movie. There's some humorous aspects as well, I think, with the line readings, although I didn't really laugh at some of the stuff others have found funny, just because the premise is just kind of unsettling and tense the entire time. That, yeah, it's a layered movie for sure, interesting. And I think Melton's good in the movie. I'm not as quite as wrapped up in the performance as others are. Like, we know Robert Downey Jr. is going to walk away with this Oscar for Oppenheimer, of course. But it sounds like his nomination's pretty, getting increasingly safer anyway. Same thing for Julianne Moore, Best Actress, interestingly enough. Moore, of course, an Oscar darling, as we know. So, yeah, I think this is it's a worthy and unique movie. Definitely worth seeing. You know, Don Haynes has a point of view for sure. I think the way the score drops in being the movie with the piano keys definitely got my attention as well. Also, I just want to shout out Elizabeth Yu, who plays one of Gracie and Joe's kids who's about to graduate. She'll be playing Azula in Avatar The Last Airbender live action series for Netflix next year. So I'm looking forward to seeing more of her, assumingly with more lines and more things to do. But she seemed actually pretty solid in a very, very small role in May, December. But yeah, interesting film. Overall, I think it's a good movie, even if it's a bit hard to completely wrap your arms all the way around. But I also think it's a movie that probably has a lot of things to interpret and think about and fixate on, depending on the viewer, which also is, I think, the signs of something interesting at the very least. So yeah, let me know, how did you feel about Netflix and Todd Haynes' May, December? What was your favorite aspect about it? Are you on the Charles Melton Oscar train? Let me know. And for more movie reviews, subscribe, and I'll see you next time. What's up? Welcome back to Nostalgia. Dave here with a review of Godzilla Minus One, the latest Godzilla film out of Japan from Toho. This would be the 33rd Japanese Godzilla movie, the first one since Shin Godzilla in 2016. And I just have to say that this movie owns, this movie rules. This is the best Godzilla movie I've ever seen. I have not seen all the Godzilla movies, not even most of them, but of all the kaiju movies in general I've seen, I think this is the best one. This movie ripped. I have so much to get into, so much I liked about this. So please seek out this movie if you haven't, because I think it was great. So yeah, I actually didn't know this coming into Godzilla Minus One, but Godzilla is actually the longest running film franchise. The first Godzilla came out in 1954, which means it was 8 years prior to Dr. No, the first James Bond movie. I would not have guessed that, but that is pretty cool. And this movie is actually coming out in celebration of the 70th anniversary of Godzilla, even though technically the 70th anniversary is not until next year, 2024, because of course Toho, maker of most of the Godzilla movies, has an agreement with Legendary Pictures for the American-made Godzilla movies, the MonsterVerse, that they cannot release movies in the same year as each other. So Toho is actually celebrating the anniversary a year early, you know, really a month early. It's all good. And honestly, what a time to be alive if you're a fan of Godzilla, because we have the Monarch Legacy of Monsters, MonsterVerse show currently running on Apple TV+, and we're getting next year Godzilla X Kong: The New Empire, the latest film from the MonsterVerse, from Legendary. So a lot of Godzilla content, a lot of Godzilla fun. And I think it's all pretty high quality. I was a big fan of the Monarch show thus far. Check that review out as well. And of course, I'll be covering the new movie next year. Yeah, so it's a wonderful time, I think, to be with Godzilla. And we've come a long way, because if you recall, Shin Godzilla, that was a reboot from Japan and Toho back in 2016. Before that, we hadn't had a Godzilla movie out of Japan since 2004. So I think Shin Godzilla is pretty cool and interesting as like a Godzilla movie focused on the failures of bureaucracy and red tape in terms of containing and combating a threat such as Godzilla, right? And Godzilla Minus One, I think the way this movie really shines is it has a really good setting, post-war Japan, and as a result, really lends itself to, I think, really rousing and effective and moving, heartfelt character work. And I'll get into that later. And that was kind of a surprise for me to get actually like meaningful character moments out of a Godzilla movie. Usually Godzilla is the star of his movies, like other kaiju films. That's usually how these movies go. We watch them to see the kaiju stomp and destroy, and then ponder, you know, the despondent feelings you get from that. So it's both spectacle and kind of somberness. And in the case of Godzilla Minus One, you also have like, I think, really great VFX. Like, Godzilla looks awesome, and tonally, I just think the movie's really spot on. So I was honestly blown away by this movie. And I think what's really smart about it is the way it starts. You know, we're introduced to our lead protagonist, Shikishima, who is a kamikaze pilot in 1945, at the very end of World War II. And he kind of bails, we learn this later, bails on a kamikaze run, his sortie, to go fuel up at a pilot outpost, basically an island off the Pacific. And quickly, they get attacked by Godzilla. But the thing about this set piece, which is so effective and immediately communicates the terror of, you know, a being like Godzilla, is that this is in pure dark. And you get, I think, a really great jump scare right in the beginning, one of the scariest moments in the movie right there. And you just kind of watch Godzilla terrorize and destroy most of the people on this island. And this is Godzilla, you know, pre being mutated by a nuclear bomb test of any kind. He's small. He's not that big yet, but still terrifying in the darkness. Of course, we see a brief flash of the Bikini Atoll tests, resulting in the mutations that Godzilla will develop, kind of traditional Godzilla origin story as we know. And, you know, then, you know, from here, we spend most of our time, you know, in Tokyo with Shikishima as he's trying to literally rebuild his life on the rubble of his family home. And the rest of the movie takes place in a few years prior, I think it's like 1946, 1947. And the character work, they really get the foundation going quickly, because you have Shikishima, whose parents are gone, his family is gone, also having a lot of survivor skill and disgrace as a cowardly kamikaze pilot who did not do his duty. And he encounters Noriko, who is a woman who also has no family left, and she is becoming the care of a newborn baby who's not hers. So they kind of develop, kind of out of convenience and necessity, this platonic family between the three of them, really centered on taking care of this young kid who someone has to take care of, you know, playing to their own humanity. And they grow closer together, even if it remains a platonic relationship. And Shikishima, he's able to find work as a minesweeper out in the ocean, and actually get some decent money to help rebuild their lives and take care of each other. And that kind of leads us into one of the other great, I think, moments about this movie, is everything we spend out at sea in the beginning, really awesome Jaws homage, man. Godzilla, when he's like under the water with his fins, the dorsal plates like sticking out, again, it's terrifying, because you know these men you're watching are completely helpless against this beast. And I think it's another really great set piece out of the movie. And you see this one moment where, I'll just kind of skip through the movie at this point, there's this one moment where the famous Japanese frigate, the Takao frigate, comes in and kind of saves Shikishima and his team on the minesweeper boat, kind of helping them out. And we see Godzilla use his, you know, nuclear laser breath for the first time. I think the way that is filmed is pretty epic, honestly, where like the sound design like briefly cuts out the sound. And it's like a flash and a pause and then just a, you know, incineration via the blast. Very reminiscent of The Last Jedi with the Holdo maneuver with the sound design and like the cut, you know, like that. I think it's really well done. And again, very terrifying. You know, from there, when we see Godzilla attack Tokyo on land for the first time and kind of terrorize Ginza, you see Godzilla upright next to skyscrapers, people fleeing, very classic imagery. And you get the classic Godzilla theme song drop. And it's like, wow, like this is just like as good as it gets to me with like that kind of kaiju stuff, you know. And that theme song, of course, famously sampled by Pharaoh Monk, Simon Says 30 years ago. That shit rocks. Like that is a hard ass theme in general. And again, Godzilla is terrifying. Yeah, and I think from here, what's really cool about the movie too is how it starts to get quite rousing, where the all these basically Navy veterans, military veterans from the war, they realize that they have to kind of come together and hatch a plan to defeat Godzilla because they can't rely on the Japanese government. And they also can't count on the Americans to help because the Americans are afraid of inflaming tensions with the Soviets. Obviously, we're in the Cold War period at this point. And that's, again, a pretty common theme across Godzilla storytelling is like the failure of government to protect those who need it, right? Obviously, Shin Godzilla had a lot of influences from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant disaster, right? Like this is obviously a very common thing for Godzilla to return to. But in this case, I think it really lent itself to like having all these people rise up. You have this meeting where the men decide that they're going to lock in and do this. And they know that they're going to risk their lives in the process. And many of them may die trying to do this. And it's like a really like epic moment. Like it's like really like hoorah thing. And, you know, watching them hatch the plan out at sea, you know, using Freon canisters to try and kill Godzilla with pressure by dropping him into a trench off the coast of Japan. All that was really cool. Also, I think the buildup to Shikishima using the prototype Shinden like fighter plane, one of the only planes they had access to following all the Japanese Zeros getting decommissioned, having him use that plane as like the last resort to face Godzilla, reconciling with the mechanic who survived with him off the island at the very beginning of the movie, them bridging their differences and coming together for the sake of Japan and their lives. That was pretty epic. And like, I knew, like, again, spoilers, I guess, but like, I knew that he had the ejector seat. That was pretty obvious, even though they don't tell you it, like they're going to lead you into that. But like, seeing Shikishima fly the fighter with the bomb strapped into Godzilla's mouth, and then the revelation that he is, in fact, alive at the top, like, I don't know, man. I was pretty moved by like a lot of those rousing moments. I think all of it worked. Could you say some of it's a little cheesy or predictable? Sure. Are these characters much more than their archetypes? Not really. But to me, all of it really works, you know? And I think it's a really effective use of Godzilla, the terror of Godzilla, but also what Godzilla storytelling can do best, where it actually is about, you know, humanity and how people can come together, like that kind of thing. You know, I think I'm a fan of the MonsterVerse films, but the human characters are definitely on the weaker side of things with those movies. I think this is really some of the best character work we've got out of a kaiju film in some time. So I was a huge fan of Godzilla Minus One. I mean, heck, even the title, right? Godzilla Minus One, where Japan was starting from zero post-World War II, but then Godzilla shows up, so they're minus one, setting even further back. Really smart. I think it's a really effective use of the setting, and the family stuff really worked for me. You know, I was really, really invested, I think, in everything going on. And a lot of that early stuff kind of reminiscent of like Studio Ghibli's Grave of the Fireflies, right? It is dark. It is sad. People are starving. And, you know, Japan is wrecked post all the firebombing in Tokyo, right? So I think everything really kind of worked. And the VFX are great. Godzilla is, I think, really terrifying and used awesomely. And of course, the movie ends with him slowly regenerating in the bottom of the ocean as we need him to do. All good. This movie is awesome. And yeah, shout out Toho for this, they really outdid themselves, I think, with this one. And man, we're gonna get so much more Godzilla with Monarch and the new movie next year. Can't wait. But let me know, how did you feel about Godzilla Minus One? What kind of kaiju fan are you? Do you have this at the very top of all the movies you've seen with kaiju, like me? Let me know. And for more movie reviews, subscribe, and I'll see you next time. All right, that's gonna do it for the pod this week. Next week, more movies, more music coming at a Sundance. Eileen, starring Thomas and Mackenzie and Anne Hathaway. Looking forward to that. On Netflix, Sam Esmail's new film, Leave the World Behind, starring Julia Roberts, Ethan Hawke, and Mahershala Ali. Let's go. Also, Cord Jefferson's American Fiction. I have a chance to see that early. Looking forward to seeing that, starring Jeffrey Wright. And the new music, Tate McRae's next album, and also Nicki Minaj's latest album, Pink Friday 2, first album in 5 years. So make sure you subscribe, youtube.com/nostalgiapod, linktree.com/nostalgiapod. See the links below. Leave a review, leave a rating, do the thing. Make sure you come back, because the best of year-end pods are coming. Best music, movies, TV, etc. Stick around for those, as well as the weekly pods throughout the end of the year. Let me know what's good, and I'll see you next week.